older daughter, Hannah, had a famously difficult passage through adolescence, in the course of which she dropped out of school, crashed all our attempts to discipline her, and lived in a state of open warfare with us. Out of desperation, we enrolled her in Urban Pioneers, a program of non-academic learning that focused on an intense exposure to the wilderness. The kids in this program, many of them with histories similar to hers, took rigorous training in climbing, rappelling, and other wilderness skills, and then went out for an extended exploration of the High Sierras. On the last day of this trip, the kids were split up into small groups and sent out on their own without guides or counselors. It was supposed to be an exercise in self-reliance, but on the day in question, a fierce and sudden storm overcame the Sierras, and Hannah's group became lost. For 4 days, they staggered through the mountains, pelted by high winds, rain, and snow, running out of food and water, soaked to the bone. Several of them came down with hypothermia. Hannah kept one of these kids alive by lying on top of her and warming her with the heat of her body for an entire night. The kids all came to believe that they were doomed. Certainly Hannah believed this. But a helicopter spotted them on the 4th day, and when Hannah came home, she was positively radiant. There was a glow in her face as she told us what had happened. When she believed she was going to die, she had a great illumination. She realized how much she loved us and how bad she felt about the way our relationship had been going in recent years. She felt bad about the way her life was going, too. But everything would be different now. She had seen the light. She was going to change. She came home on a Friday. By Sunday, it was quite clear that everything was depressingly the same. She stayed out all night on Saturday, and on Sunday we had another terrible fight. My wife and I shrugged our shoulders. "So much for everything being different," we said. But 6 months later, it was quite clear that everything was different, and that the change could be clearly traced to her near-death experience in the Sierras. So the process of teshuvah is neither clear nor linear. And who is the principal actor in all this? Is it us, or is it God? In the passage from Netzavim, sometimes we are the subject of the turning, and sometimes God is the subject, all of which seems to suggest that teshuvah, transformation, is a reciprocal process that depends on both God and us. No one else can do transformation for us, but on the other hand, we can't do it by ourselves either. The possibility of transformation always exists, but we have to consciously turn toward it in order to activate it. At the same time, our initiative can only take us so far. After that, we have to have faith. We have to depend on the universe to support the flowering of our intention. So, the first 10 verses of Deuteronomy 30 give us a very accurate picture of this process of transformation, its complexity, its interactive quality, its confusing non-linear course. But the next 4 verses give us some extraordinarily direct and clear advice about precisely how to do teshuvah, how to effect our own transformation. Because this commandment to do teshuvah is not too wonderful for you and is not distant from you either. It is not in heaven, so you can't say, "Who can go up to heaven and bring it to us and cause us to hear it so that we can do it?" And it is not beyond the sea, so you can't say, "Who can go across the sea and bring it to us and cause us to hear it so that we can do it?" But the word is very near to you, in your mouth and in your heart, so you can do it. Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 11 through 14. Teshuvah begins with a turn away from the external world and toward the inner realm of the heart. We effect this turn in many ways. If we are not used to solitude or contemplation, if we are normally consumed by a frantic round of activity, if we live our lives at a rapid pace, then simply stopping, simply coming to synagogue every day and praying, setting aside a small period of time each day for contemplation, observing the Sabbath or some other conscious retreat from the world of activity and stress, can suddenly leave us in confrontation with the contents of our heart. These contents are an open secret. We already know this secret. Often all that's required of us is to be still for a moment, and the heart begins to disclose itself to us of its own accord. But the heart is a mysterious and complex thing. The irony is, if we are experienced at prayer or meditation, if we already observe a regular period of retreat from the frenetic rush of worldly activity, we might find the heart more difficult to find. We might already have some familiarity with the feelings and impulses that are sitting on the surface of our heart, and we might need a more concerted effort to get beneath that. In the chapter on Elul, we reviewed the role prayer and meditation play in this process. Both of these activities sneak up on the heart. They disarm the heart by focusing on something else, the breath, or the body, or the words of the prayer book, and then the heart, which has always craved our attention anyway, unwittingly discloses itself by stealing our attention away from our breathing or our prayers with a continuous stream of thoughts and feelings and impulses. But why does the heart require such an indirect approach? Why won't it just open wide when we ask it to? Why does it resist us so? We are sentimental about the heart, but the truth is most of us spend a great deal of time and energy avoiding the heart at all costs. Really, we are afraid of what we might find there. We don't even know where it is or how we might find it, but somehow we understand there is a lot of pain there. If we are human, we suffer. The heart holds our suffering. The pain we most need to deal with is sitting right there in our hearts in plain sight, or else it is just inside its dark chambers. In either case, we are not inclined to look at it. We live in a culture that conditions us to avoid suffering, and the consequence of this is that we live at some distance from our heart. We are not in the habit of looking at it, but of distracting ourselves from its content. As we begin the process of teshuvah, we need to make a conscious effort to overcome the momentum of this denial and avoidance. This is an effort well worth making. That pain, that afflictive energy that rests on the surface of our hearts and just below it as well, will be the catalyst for our transformation. The nature of our pain points us to the nature of the transformation we need to make. If we are angry, we need to move toward inhabiting our anger and then letting go of it. If we are in despair, we need to move toward hope. But the intensity of our pain is even more helpful in this process than its particular cast. As we sit in the boundless field of mind during the 10 days of transformation, impulses and feelings rise up and fall away all around us. Those impulses and feelings that assert themselves with particular force are the ones we are most likely to follow. This is the great gift of suffering. Intense, afflictive states, anger, boredom, fear, guilt, impatience, grief, disappointment, dejection, anxiety, despair, are the great markers of our teshuvah. By their very intensity, they call us to transformation. These feelings are so familiar to us, we usually believe them to be part of our intrinsic being. They are not. And in this sacred time of transformation, while the gates of heaven are open and we are finally awake, we can see that they are not. We can see that they are just impulses arising for a moment, the way wind and rain and snow arise for a moment in the world. They are wind and rain and snow, but they are not the world. They are not us. They only become us by our own choice, by our choosing to see them that way, by our choosing to cling to them so tenaciously. We can make another choice if we wish to. We can choose to allow these feelings to rise up, and then let them fall away again like a hot breeze. And this is the simplest and most frightening truth about all this business. Anger is a choice. Boredom is a choice. Fear is a choice. No one can hold a gun to our heads in this regard. No one can make us feel this feeling. No one can crawl inside us and alter us. We are responsible for the state of our own consciousness. The great drama of this season is the drama of choice. The power of choice is immense. We can choose to let go of anger, boredom, fear, guilt, impatience, grief, disappointment, dejection, anxiety, and despair. And we can make this choice moment by moment. And we can make this choice in a broader way as well. We can let go of each constituent feeling as we become aware of it, and we can form a clear and continuous intention to let these feelings go. When we recite the great formula of Rebbe Nachman, for example, if anyone has hurt or harmed me knowingly or unknowingly, I forgive them, we are planting the seeds of forgiveness and love. We are awakening the powerful force of intention in our minds. And even if it doesn't bear fruit right away, even if we don't feel a great rush of love at first, we can trust the laws of nature and the power of intention to support the flowering of forgiveness in our souls and in the world. We form our intention, and then we let heaven and earth bear witness. Opening to forgiveness, we begin to see it all around us. The 10 days of Teshuvah are days of renewal, days when we are not only concerned with change and transformation, but also with reinvigorating, refreshing, and reimagining our lives, days when we are obliged to ask ourselves a number of difficult and unpleasant questions. What do we do when we run out of gas? What do we do when we feel like we're running on empty? What do we do when everything we do seems dull? When life seems barren and drained of color and taste, when the landscape that used to thrill us with its beauty now lies before us flat and dull, its radiance drained away. What do we do when we can't summon the enthusiasm we used to have for our work or for our marriage or even for a simple walk through the world? What do we do when we admit to ourselves in the secret darkness of our heart that we really don't care anymore about the things we used to care about? Here we are in the life or the job or the marriage that we got ourselves into when we did care. Here we are, daily required to espouse feelings and principles and justifications we once fervently believed, but which we now neither feel nor believe anymore. What do we do when we are daily afflicted with a sense of having sold out? Of going through the motions, of doing something we don't really believe in? What do we do when we realize we are suffering from that contemporary epidemic, the burnout syndrome? What do we do when our life becomes characterized by a sense of meaninglessness, by a loss of passion, by fatigue and depression? What do we do, that is, besides divorce our spouses, drink ourselves into oblivion, drug ourselves insensate, drown ourselves in shopping or television or sports, or try to simulate passion with gambling, pornography, or illicit sex? And what do we do when our religious life begins to feel this way? When the first intoxication with Shabbat begins to pale? When we no longer feel that extra wave of spirituality descending on us at the onset of Shabbat as we used to? What happens when the prayer service no longer brings us into a sense of communion with God? What happens when the words of the prayer service no longer mean anything to us, no longer connect us with the long continuity of Jewish spirituality, but instead begin to grate? What happens when we become so tired of them we can't bear to hear them anymore? What happens when they just seem to drone on and on? What happens when meditation ceases to be a daily entry into a deeper state of consciousness and becomes an endless reiteration of the most puerile and mundane thoughts imaginable? The great Zen teacher Shunju Suzuki wrote, "It is hard to keep our mind pure and our practice pure. The goal of practice is always to keep our beginner's mind. Suppose you recite a prayer only once. It might be a very good recitation. But what would happen to you if you recited it twice, 3 times, 4 times or more? You might easily lose your original attitude towards it. The same thing will happen in your other practices. For a while, you will keep your beginner's mind, but if you continue to practice 1, 2, 3 years or more, although you may improve some, you are liable to lose the limitless meaning of original mind." God renews the entire world every day. We make this declaration every day in our prayer service, acknowledging that every day can be a newly experienced birth, and that we can once again see the world with the newness of a child. And we also thank God every day for the miracles that are constantly with us, evening, morning, and afternoon. But how do we attune ourselves to this miracle when all we feel is dull and stale? How do we recapture our sense of what the eminent scholar and theologian Abraham Joshua Heschel called wonder or radical amazement? How do we recapture a sense of poetry, joy, and surprise in what now seems old and stale? How do we avoid routinization? In the Midrash Sifre on Deuteronomy, we read, "Take to heart these words that I charge you today. Hayom, today. These words are not to be in your sight like some old ordinance to which no one is paying attention any longer, but they are to be in your sight like a new ordinance toward which everyone is running." Or, in the words of the scholar and philosopher Martin Buber, "When we do not believe that God renews the work of creation every day, then our religious practice becomes old and routine and boring. As it says in the Psalms, 'Do not cast me off when I am old.' That is, do not let my world become old." Or, in the words of Abraham Joshua Heschel, "As civilization advances, the sense of wonder declines. Such decline is an alarming symptom of our state of mind. Mankind will not perish for want of information, but only for want of appreciation. The beginning of our happiness lies in the understanding that life without wonder is not worth living. What we lack is not a will to believe, but a will to wonder." Heschel is warning us, this is not a mere theological problem, it is a matter of life and death. There are people who die from burnout, and from the spiritual and emotional deadening that comes in its wake. I have seen such people with my own eyes. They have strokes, they have heart attacks. I have sat by the sides of their beds. Sometimes they actually die from these things, and sometimes they live on but in a deep state of depression, a living death, but a death nonetheless. There are people who are dead even when alive. Rashi, the great medieval Torah commentator, suggests that when we read in the book of Deuteronomy, "I have put before you this day life and death, a blessing and a curse, therefore choose life," the verse is talking about spiritual life and spiritual death. The blessing is refreshment, the renewal of the soul. The curse is boredom, staleness, frustration, failure. But what can we do when we find ourselves spiritually dead while still breathing? How do we transform this curse into its corresponding blessing? Our first inclination is often to change the external circumstances of our life, to change our physical environment. "Don't just stand there," we tell ourselves. "Do something. Do anything." This is actually a solution Jewish tradition sometimes suggests as well. "Change your place, change your luck," the Talmud tells us. Perhaps if we make a major life change, if we actually move to another city or another state, our luck will change as well. The conventional wisdom these days is that you can change your situation, but your problems will continue to pursue you. And while this is often true, sometimes the situation is the problem. Sometimes we just have the wrong job. Sometimes we are just stuck in a bad relationship. In such cases, change your place, change your luck can be good advice. Most of the time, however, the conventional wisdom is correct. We can change our lives around completely, change careers, divorce our husbands, move to another city, and this feeling of deadness might even go away for a while. But far more often than not, it will return, and return with a vengeance. Far more often, the problem is within, and not without. This, the psychologists tell us, is why there are so many suicides on the Golden Gate Bridge. San Francisco is a place many people come to out of a belief in change your place, change your luck. It is a place many come to because they believe their problem is that they live in Fairlawn, New Jersey. So they move someplace else, and then they move someplace else again, and then finally they end up in San Francisco, the most beautiful city in the world. And after a very brief while, All the unhappiness they felt in Fairlawn, New Jersey, returns, and they feel desperate. But here, the land ends. There is nowhere else to go. They feel as if they have cashed in their last option. As the writer and meditation teacher John Kabat-Zinn reminds us, wherever we go, there we are. So moving ourselves to someplace else rarely solves anything. Sometimes, however, a simple change in routine might really suffice to set off the kind of inner change this problem demands. Heschel writes that the greatest hindrance to awareness of the divine is our adjustment to conventional notions and mental clichés. Wonder, or radical amazement, he suggests, is a state of maladjustment to words and notions. Moshe Cordovero, the great medieval Kabbalist, also recommends a kind of intentional maladjustment as a strategy for returning to God. It is a good idea to make some sort of alteration in your food and drink and in your clothing, he writes. For example, one week, do not eat fruit. Another week, do not eat meat or drink wine, or do not eat hot food. I had a friend once who had divorced her husband. They had shared a great house together, and she had gotten the house in the divorce settlement, but now she faced a terrible problem. She loved the house, but how could she stay in it without being constantly reminded of the marriage? Finally, she hit upon a solution. She changed all the furniture in the house around. She changed the orientation of every room. Furniture that used to face north and south now faced east and west, and vice versa. It worked perfectly. She stayed in the house, but she felt as if she had a new life in it. Spiritual deadness is a habit. Something in us wants to be dead, wants to escape our reality, and we've expressed this desire in 100 little patterns and habits. So a physical shaking up of our stale routines might actually serve to loosen us up inside and lead the way to inner change. David Roskies, a professor of Jewish literature at the Jewish Theological Seminary, speaks frequently of the need to defamiliarize the liturgy, to set old words in new melodies and old melodies in new words. Marcia Falk, whose Book of Blessings offers us a radical retranslation of traditional liturgy, shakes up the classical liturgy so thoroughly that cracks appear in our apprehension of it, and more than once, I have found God coming in through these cracks. But we can only change our external routines so many times before this remedy stops working too. When I was being interviewed at rabbinical school, one of my interrogators asked me why I had written G-D instead of God in my admissions essays. I told him that I didn't want to get habituated to the word God. I didn't want to speak of God without really thinking of or experiencing God, so I used a hyphen to remind me that the word is not the same thing as God. Well, what happens when you get habituated to G-D, he asked me. Well, then I guess I'll go to an asterisk, I replied. But his point was well taken. Eventually, the asterisk stops working too, and sooner or later we have to address the inner roots of the problem of burnout and routinization directly. Fortunately for us, our tradition has many useful suggestions as to how we might do this. You should turn your mind toward God before you pray, before you study Torah, and before you eat, says Rabbi Moshe Teitelbaum. Turn your mind toward God. This sounds like a simple, even a self-evident proposition, but it's an essential first step in the process of spiritual renewal. The first thing we should do when we feel we have lost all our passion is to try to find it. This involves a kind of inner turning, an expression of will, an expression of faith, the belief that, like God, this passion exists even though we neither feel it nor see it at the moment. There is a paradigm well mapped out in the novels of Hermann Hesse, especially Siddhartha. Siddhartha is the story of a young monk who is lured away from a long and extremely devoted spiritual path by his lust for a beautiful woman, a lust that alters the course of his life. He becomes a businessman, totally involved in the corruption and the pleasures of ordinary life. He marries, becomes dissolute, takes up gambling and adultery, and loses his wife. His son rebels against him and finally rejects him altogether, causing him unbearable pain. Finally, broken and despairing, he becomes a recluse, a ferryman, carrying people back and forth across the river. And there on the river, the deep and abiding wisdom he sought in his youth begins to ripen in his soul until he finally comes to the following understanding. The world is not imperfect or slowly evolving along a path to perfection. No, it is perfect at every moment. Every sin already carries grace within it. All small children are potential old men. All sucklings have death within them. All dying people, eternal life. Everything is good. Everything is perfect. Death as well as life. Sin as well as holiness. Wisdom as well as folly. Everything is necessary. Everything needs only my agreement, my assent, my loving understanding, my turning toward. The critical moment in this story is a subtle turn of mind. A moment when the hero must bring his consciousness back to the path he abandoned, back to the path he has imagined doesn't even exist anymore. There are times in my own religious life when prayer brings me into a very strong and immediate sense of the presence of God. But then there are long dry spells when this doesn't happen, and I begin to doubt myself and to wonder if it ever happened at all or if I simply imagined it. What usually brings me out of such a dry spell is a simple inner turn. I simply turn toward that inner place, that radiant nexus of mind, heart, and soul where I used to feel the presence of God, and lo and behold, God is still there waiting for me. Renewal often begins when we turn toward this place, even when it seems utterly distant. In our tradition, this turning often takes the form of prayer. If because of my sins, which are many and great, there is no angel to defend me, then do you yourself see that a hole is dug under the wall of your heavenly palace for me to squeeze through and come into your presence. So reads Rabbeinu Yonah's famous prayer of reconciliation with God, a prayer that we might squeeze into God's presence at those times when we feel squeezed out. And Rabbi David Lida, a Spanish Kabbalist, said, "Accustom yourself to say again and again, 'Create for me, God, a pure heart and renew within me an upright heart.'" Prayer creates space for this renewal. Prayer galvanizes our will. Prayer opens us to the possibility of change so that we notice when an opening arises, which we might not have noticed without being so prepared. So, step number one in the process of spiritual renewal, according to our tradition, is this kind of subtle inner turning, either through prayer or through faith. Step number two is almost precisely the opposite. It involves neither turning nor any kind of movement at all. It involves being still. When we defy the sense of meaninglessness that afflicts us, galvanize ourselves for transformation, and open ourselves to the possibility of change, we in no way deny or run away from the reality of our situation. In fact, we do exactly the opposite. We embrace the emptiness. It is precisely our failure to inhabit our life which has rendered it dull and meaningless. So, while we defy the meaninglessness of our life, the act of defiance consists in our refusal to run away, and our resolve instead to fill it with our consciousness. We live it, and then we dare it to remain dull and meaningless. One of Rebbe Nachman's most famous stories is about a prince who came to believe he was a turkey. He took off all his clothes and got under the table and lived there on scraps and crumbs and bones. The king called in many doctors, but none of them could cure him. Finally, he called in a certain wise man who took off his own clothes and sat down under the table with him. "I am a turkey," the prince told him. "I am a turkey too," the wise man said. The two of them sat there together for a very long time, and then the wise man said, "Do you think a turkey can't wear a shirt? You can wear a shirt and still be a turkey." So the prince put on a shirt. Do you think you can't be a turkey and wear trousers? So the prince put on his trousers, too, and in this way the wise man coaxed the prince to put on all his clothes, to eat real food, and finally to come up from under the table and to sit at the table. In the end, the prince was completely cured. Avraham Greenbaum, a contemporary interpreter of Rabbi Nachman's work, writes, "The wise man went under the table, and the very first thing he did, his first lesson, was just to sit there. You might have thought he would have been anxious to get started and take the first steps in his plan to cure the prince. In fact, sitting was the first step. Indeed, if you think about the story as a whole, you notice that most of the time the wise man took to cure the prince was spent just sitting with him. This is because the ability to sit calmly is one of the most important prerequisites of clear-headedness. The Hebrew term for a calm, settled state of mind, yishuv hada'at, is bound up with the concept of sitting. Da'at is awareness or consciousness, intellectual, emotional, meditative, intuitive, or all of the above. The word yishuv is a noun from the Hebrew root yashav, meaning to sit or to dwell or to inhabit. The verb yashav also has a transitive form, le yashev, which means to cause someone to sit or dwell, which in plain English would be to settle. Yishuv hada'at means to settle the mind. A yishuv is a settlement, a habitation, a place where people have set down a foundation and are making a stand or a sit. So sitting in this sense not only signifies the physical act of seating the body quietly, it also suggests the whole principle of taking a break from the activities of day-to-day living in order to fully inhabit our lives. The Hebrew word for sitting is thus connected with the idea of Shabbat, when we pause and sit back from our workaday activities in order to cultivate the spirit, to inhabit our lives with spirit and consciousness. A certain Rebbe had a close disciple who fell into a long period of staleness that troubled him deeply. He felt as if all meaning had been drained from his life, and when he prayed, his prayers turned to chalk and died in his mouth before he could utter them. The Rebbe, aware of his disciple's problem, took him out of the village to a deep, dark forest. Before they entered the forest, the Rebbe said to the student, "As you are entering the forest, ask God to give you the answer to your dilemma. Then, forget about this prayer because you must pay very close attention to the path through the forest. Otherwise, you'll get lost and never come out of the forest alive." So the student entered the forest, asking God for the answer to his struggle, and then he lost himself in following the path. As his rabbi had instructed him, he devoted all his attention to the path itself. Soon he began to take great pleasure in this path. He took pleasure in the working of his body as it found its own pace on the path and in the fall of his foot on the cool forest floor. He was taken with the path itself, a verdant, mossy path of deep, brilliant green. When he finally came out of the forest, he was smiling broadly. The Rebbe asked, "Did God give you an answer?" The student started to weep. "I forgot all about the question," he said. "I put all my attention on the path, and after a while I took so much pleasure in what was in front of my face that I forgot about the question altogether." "In that case," the Rebbe said, "I would say that God gave you your answer." The present moment is the only place we experience ourselves as being alive, the only place we experience our lives at all. The walk through the forest, the focus on the path, on the process of life, rather than on some goal or end that exists beyond the present tense reality of our lives, this is the answer God provided for this student. You don't feel your life. Your life is dead to you because you aren't in it. If you want it to come alive again, if you want it to bristle with wonder and intensity, then you have to inhabit it. That dead, meaningless life that troubles you so. So inhabit your life. Be present in it and watch the gray concrete turn a brilliant emerald green. Sometimes we can't inhabit our lives because there's simply no room for us there. we might find our lives so clogged with dead weight, dead feelings, extraneous objects, and concerns, that there's no room for the next live moment to occur. The Torah has some excellent advice about how to nurture our spiritual passion in such a circumstance. It comes in the 6th chapter of Leviticus, in the instructions to the priests on how to keep the fire on the altar burning continually. And he shall take up the ashes which the fire has consumed, and place them beside the altar, and he shall remove the ashes outside the camp, and the fire will be kept burning this way. It won't go out. When we feel dead inside, it is often because there are old ideas we no longer believe in or haven't challenged in far too long, old feelings we really don't feel anymore, but cling to desperately, afraid of what might happen if we admit we don't feel them. Without our realizing it, these things have suffocated us, crowding the life out of our soul. Sometimes they can be reinvigorated, refreshed, or reimagined, but sometimes they must be removed. We must simply let go of them. The altar must be emptied so that the light may keep burning. Shunju Suzuki writes, "If your mind is empty, it is always ready for anything. It is open to everything. In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few. In the beginner's mind, there is no thought, 'I have attained something.' All self-centered thoughts limit our vast mind. When we have no thought of achievement, no thought of self, we are true beginners." This apparently was well understood by Rabbi Nachman, whose chronicler and close disciple Natan tells the following story. When the Rebbe was involved in his devotions, everything he did required great toil and effort. No form of devotion came easily, and the Rebbe literally had to lay down his life in many cases. Each thing required tremendous effort. He fell 1,000 times, but each time he picked himself up and served God anew. The most difficult thing was to begin serving God and accept the yoke of true devotion. Each time he would begin, he would find himself failing. He would then begin anew and stumble yet another time. This occurred countless times, over and over again. Finally, the Rebbe resolved to stand fast and maintain his foothold without paying attention to anything else in the world. From then on, his heart was firm in its devotion to God, but even so, he went up and down very many times. But by then, he was determined that he would never abandon his devotion, no matter how many times he fell. The Rebbe became accustomed to constantly beginning anew. Whenever he fell from his particular level, he did not give up. He would simply say, "I will begin anew. I will act as if I am just beginning to devote myself to God, and this is the very first time." This happened time and again, and each time he would start all over again. He would often begin anew, many times in a single day. How frightening it is to consider that the ideas and feelings that used to motivate us, the very ones we based our lives on, are dead, no longer living ideas and feelings, but dead ones that are cluttering up our lives, clouding our consciousness. After all, we have based our lives on these ideas and feelings. And if we have to give them up, if we have to let go of them, what do we do with our lives after that? Can we go on being a doctor if we don't have the same passion for healing we used to have? Can we continue to be a rabbi if all our theological assumptions have changed? But the more urgent question might be, do we still have a life in the first place? Are we dead or alive? Are we still alive, or are we just breathing, merely going through the motions of our lives? And if so, what choice do we have but to give up these dead ideas, to inhabit our lives fully, even if they seem unappealing, even if that alternative life we might be living in Fairlawn, New Jersey, seems so much more alluring and attractive? Choose life so that you may live. This is the great peroration of Parshat Netzavim. Live this life and watch it come alive again. This is also the great imperative of the 10 days of Teshuvah, those days when we stand poised between life and death. While the gates are open, we can transform deadness into life We can make the dead live again. We can choose life so that we may live. Choose this life. There is no other. Chapter 8. The soul hears its name being called. Kol Nidre. One year, just before Yom Kippur, I went to visit a sweet man who had at one time been among my congregation's most active and devoted members. We had once been quite close, but he had suffered a serious stroke some years before. Sometimes on my visits he recognized me, and sometimes he didn't. Sometimes he seemed to be quite awake, and sometimes he seemed to be off in a dream. That's how he was when I went to visit just before Yom Kippur. His wife, who had devoted herself to caring for him, kept nudging him to get him to pay attention to me, but it was no use. He was very far gone. I had come, among other reasons, to blow the shofar for him. I often do this for people who are housebound during the holidays. When I blew the shofar for this man, he came to right away. It was as if the shofar had pulled him back to life, reached down into his dream and reclaimed his soul. On another occasion, I was summoned to the house of a dying congregant. She had been the next-door neighbor and great friend of my predecessor, who was now dead himself. She wanted a rabbi present as she recited the Shema with her last dying breath. I got to the house just in time. She began to recite the Shema as soon as I arrived at her bedside. She was nearly gone, but she pulled herself back to this earth in order to say the first word. She said it with all her heart and all her soul and all her might, and then she sank back into her impending death for a moment. Then she said the second word, Yisrael, crawling all the way back up to the surface of this world in order to do so, only this time it required superhuman effort. And so it was, through the six words of the Shema. Each word seemed to pull her all the way up from death and back into life. She said the last word, Echad, and then she died. There are many ways to tell the story of how God called me back to Judaism, so whenever I tell this story, I tell it a little differently. The truth is, God had to call out to me many times, so sometimes I tell the story in terms of my involvement with Buddhism and how it made me more aware of who I really was and where I had come from. And sometimes I tell the story in terms of my marriage, how my wife and I decided to be married by a rabbi almost on a whim, how we began our observant Jewish life together on the first Shabbat after we were married. And sometimes I tell the story in terms of my son's sudden and surprising desire to have a bar mitzvah, and how that got me involved with the synagogue for the first time in my adult life, almost against my will. But long before any of that, way back in 1970, my first year in California, I was about as distant from Judaism as it was possible to be. How distant? It was the evening of Kol Nidre, the advent of Yom Kippur, and I had no idea that it was. But the TV was on in the living room of my house in Walla, California, and I just happened to be walking through the room when a news broadcast caught my attention. They were doing a feature about Yom Kippur. Someone was playing the Kol Nidre on a cello. It went through me like a knife. That melody struck a deep chord. It went all the way in. It went straight to my soul. Kol Nidre is the name of the service we perform on the eve of Yom Kippur. This service derives its name from the haunting chant with which it begins, and which is also called the Kol Nidre. When we recite the Kol Nidre, God calls out to the soul in a voice the soul recognizes instantly, because it is the soul's own cry. You may have come to this service for other reasons. Nevertheless, here you are, sitting in your body, and suddenly your soul hears this music and it gives a jump and it startles you. Your soul is hearing its name called out, and its name is pain, grief, shame, humiliation, loss, failure, death. Or at least that is its first name. That is the name the first few notes of the Kol Nidre call out. Col Nidre has an interesting if somewhat cloudy history. It seems to have been composed during the reign of Recored I, a 6th century Visigoth king of Spain who ordered Jews to convert on pain of death. So, Col Nidre was originally a cry of pain, an expression of overwhelming grief at having had to commit apostasy. Spanish Jews chanted it when they gathered secretly to observe Yom Kippur. They did the same later under the Byzantine persecution of the 9th century, and again during the papal and Spanish inquisitions of the 13th and 15th centuries. But I use the word seems advisedly. We're not really sure of any of this. The dates fit nicely, but there is no historical corroboration for this theory. It persists as a kind of folk myth. But it sure corresponds very closely to the feel of the Col Nidre service. The soul is in anguish because it has encountered a frightening obstacle to expressing itself. But it resolves to persevere, and in so doing, finds its true voice. We can hear all this quite clearly in the music itself. The chant begins with a fall, a descending minor tone, which goes on for two full phrases, but then there is a definite rise. There is the sound of pain and heartbreak, but after that comes a kind of rising emotion, a heroic, even a defiant persistence, and finally a kind of grim triumph. Many years ago, at about the same time I heard that cello playing Col Nidre, I had a friend who was learning the piano. She played Bach's First Prelude every day. This is a good piece for learning the piano because it essentially repeats one figure 32 times, altering the notes of the figure slightly with each repetition. The upper notes of this figure keep reaching higher and higher, ascending throughout the piece towards some great aspiration. But all the while, this ascent is being subtly pulled down by a kind of gravity. The bass notes of this figure do not ascend. The high notes cannot pull them up, and finally, even they begin to go down. As the high notes steadily ascend, a palpable tension builds between the ascent and the descent, until finally there is a heartbreaking moment in the music. The high notes give up. They surrender to the bass notes. And they, too, begin to descend. One day, as I was listening to my friend rehearse this piece for the 100th time, I heard the soul of all humankind in it. I heard the soaring aspirations of humanity, and I heard the force of a terrible gravity that finally brought it down. I heard the heart of all humankind cracking open. The thing about the Col Nidre is that it starts at this moment of heartbreak. This moment is its first assumption. And it comes on so suddenly, so abruptly, there is no build-up whatsoever. It's the very first thing that happens at the evening service for Yom Kippur. It happens before we even have a chance to settle in our seats. As the chant begins, we convene a Beit Din, a rabbinical court, and the first words of the chant are a legal formula. This court gives us permission to pray with the Avaryonim. What does this mean? Who are the Avaryonim, and why does a court need to convene in order to give us permission to pray with them? There is a strong and persistent folk belief that the word Avaryonim refers to the Marranos, the Jews of Spain, who had pretended to convert to Christianity but had remained secretly Jewish, and who returned to the Jewish community to say Col Nidre every year. Avaryonim, the proponents of this theory argue, may very well have been a transliteration of the word Iberians. Another theory is based on the Talmudic dictum that a public fast in which sinners do not participate is not a true fast. Avar, after all, is the word for transgression. So perhaps the Avaryonim are the transgressors, and the rabbinical court is giving us permission to pray with them. In other words, it is giving us permission to pray with ourselves. We are all Avaryonim. We are all imperfect. We are all sinners. But I think this word suggests an even deeper reality that all of us share. Not only are we all imperfect, we are all impermanent. In its simplest meaning, avar means to pass. We are the avaryonim. We are the ones who are just passing through, every one of us. The tragic pain of the soul, the pain we hear in those first grieving notes of Kol Nidre, is the pain of loss, the pain of impermanence. This is the first hurdle the soul must clear as it makes its way through the world, the first disappointment it must come to grips with. Everything passes. Everyone around us dies. The people we love, the things we love, the world around us, our parents, our grandparents, our children, our spouse, our strength, our capacities, the redwoods of California, the skyline of New York, all of it is sliding away, all this perfection sinking into the earth. And we know this. We try to hold on as hard as we can. We try to hold on to our strength and our youth. We try to hold on to each other. But we may as well try to hold back the waves of the sea. So this is the first note that is sounded in the song of the soul, and many of us never get past it. One summer, a group of us took a 7-day excursion into the deep wilderness of southeastern Alaska. We arrived in the wilderness during the end of the life cycle of the chum salmon. This is a remarkable cycle. The salmon rage up the wild rivers of Alaska to spawn, but the moment they do, they begin to lose their life force. They begin to die. They rage, they spawn, their life force dims, and they die. You can see this happening before your eyes. Their scales begin to blacken and fall off. Their jaws become locked in a kind of permanent rage. And you can see it because something else happens in this final stage of their lives, which is really quite wonderful. They begin to jump out of the water very high and very often. This is extraordinary to see. Kayaking through Tebenkoff Bay in southern Alaska, we were constantly surrounded by salmon leaping out of the water. Why do they do this? Some say it is a vestigial instinct left over from the days when they were running up the rivers and had to leap over many impediments. And some say they leap for joy, either the pure joy of the leap itself, or to celebrate that their lives have successfully run their course. They have spawned. They have kept the life cycle going. Someone on the trip said that they looked to him like pilgrims leaping from one dimension to the next, from earth to heaven, and then falling back again, stitching these dimensions together as they did. This is nothing less than a picture of the journey the soul takes through this world. This is a picture of the soul's journey to express itself, to spawn, to create what it was put on this earth to create, and then to make a leap of great joy. And the soul makes this joyous leap in spite of the fact that it knows that as soon as it expresses itself, it will begin to die. It will begin to fade away. We rise up and we fall away. We express our unique and indispensable contribution to the great flow of life, and then we pass on. We become one of the avaryonim. Yet many of us are afraid to be who we really are, precisely because we sense this. We sense that once we have risen up, we will begin to fall away. Once we have spawned, we will begin to die. Many of us would rather try to keep our lives unexpressed, in potential, because we believe that if we don't express our lives, we can hold on to them. Or we might be terrified of not expressing ourselves well enough, of failing. As long as we dream of that great novel we were always supposed to write, we never have to risk the unbearable tragedy of trying to write it and failing. Then, where are we? Then, what do we have? So we never make that joyous leap. We remain weighted down by the burden of our unexpressed dreams. The Kol Nidre expresses all this. Those first notes express this sadness, this impermanence, this heartbreak, this failure. But then there are the rising notes. Precisely because of this impermanence, this heartbreak, the soul expresses itself, expresses its singular one-time gift, leaps out of the water with joy, and then expires. Was it just me, or was all the hype and overkill we had to endure at the first anniversary of 9/11 just too much? I did my best to avoid it. I left the paper on the front stoop that day. I watched no TV, except, of course, to tune into the Giants game. But there was no escaping it. Even the Giants staged a memorial, and in spite of all my resistance, it ended up touching me deeply. It featured the simple, heart-rending sound of bagpipes playing Amazing Grace, while out in McCovey Cove, people set a small flotilla of flowered wreaths afloat to honor the many victims of 9/11 who had lived in the Bay Area. Flight 93 was heading for San Francisco when its heroic passengers brought it down. And then there was the most beautiful touch of all. They didn't have anyone throw out a ceremonial first pitch, as is often done on such occasions. Instead, the mother of one of the victims merely laid the ball on the mound. The simple eloquence of this gesture called to mind the immensity of loss far more effectively than any words could have. And the keening of the bagpipes, like the Kol Nidre, was a cry of the soul, a cry of impermanence. The soul-numbing sadness of so much death could suddenly be felt. Never mind the theology, never mind the politics, never mind the cheap patriotism. That thin and lonely call of the pipes and that ball lying unthrown on the mound evoked the full sadness of this loss. But there was also a sense, as there is in the melody of the Kol Nidre, of the rise after the fall, of the soul engaging with its pain and then going on with its full strength, a strength strangely drawn from the pain itself. Eventually someone said, "Play ball," and they played ball. They picked up that ball and threw it, and the game went on. About that salmon jumping again, and particularly the theory that the fish jumps as a vestigial instinct left over from the days when he was running the great rivers and leaping over impediments along the way, I think this image also tells us something about the soul's journey. God calls to us from the depths of our despair. It is often the case, I think, that our soul hears its call in the midst of great trial and pain. The soul's journey through the world is a twisted and often painful path, but the soul seems to grow from its suffering and from the impediments it encounters. Rabbi Nachman said that when the soul hears its call and begins its journey back to God, God immediately begins to raise up impediments, because God knows that it strengthens the soul to overcome impediments, and because it is human nature, it is the nature of the soul to yearn for precisely that which is difficult to attain. My mother has been struggling with Alzheimer's disease for 10 or 12 years now. I remember observing wistfully from the pulpit 10 years ago that someday my mother was going to look at me and not even know who I was, not even recognize me. Well, that day has come, and it has been devastating, not only because of what it means in terms of my mother's condition, not only because it is as if I've already lost her, even though she's still here, but because it touches a very deep nerve for me, a fear of not being recognized for who I am. For many years, I walked around in this world with a lot of anger toward my parents. My parents had always wanted me to be a doctor. There were only two alternatives for me in this world, to be a doctor or to be a failure. I tried to be accommodating. I took pre-med courses. I took chemistry, but I kept causing explosions and breaking expensive laboratory equipment. And finally, the chemistry department offered me a deal. They would give me a passing grade in the chemistry class I was taking on the condition that I would promise never to take any more courses in the chemistry department. I accepted the deal, and that was the end of my medical career. It was just as well. My parents' desire to have me become a doctor had absolutely nothing to do with the person I actually was. They simply never saw that person. When I finally stopped trying to be who they wanted me to be and pursued my own path, my real talents began to emerge. I finished at the top of my graduate school class. I finished at the top of my class at rabbinical school, and my parents hardly noticed. I spent many years in a rage because of this, which was, I admit, a little silly. My parents were wonderful parents. They were loving and generous to a fault. But this knot of pain and anger persisted. They just didn't see who I was, and it hurt me deeply. But one day, I was sitting on a beach, and it suddenly came to me